Welcome to Home and Family Finance with Paul Barry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is sponsored by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and by CUNA, the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Barry.
As always, good to be with you on a very, very hot day, but so are many of the days as we go through summer, hot and humid, and I hope wherever you are, you have a chance to cool it down. But as we always start our program, and we will do that today, we will ask that question, are you financially fit? I had somebody call me and say, you know, Mr. Barry, when you ask, how do I know whether I'm financially fit? Well, there are lots of ways, but let me give you my quick overview of that. Okay, are you making more than you spend? Or are you spending more than you make? If you're making more than you spend, that's one of the first steps to being financially fit. Do you have 6 months of savings to meet all expected expenses? That is your survival package. 6 months to pay for everything that you're paying for right now. Can you do it? Now, the emergency part of that is for what you don't expect. So not only do you have the 6 months set aside, but you've also got an emergency slush fund. Something that can help you. That's part of being financially fit. And are you saving at least 6% of your income or 5% of your income on a monthly basis? Whatever you make, if you make it at the Vegas table, put 5% of everything you make away every month. 5%. You'll thank me for that at some point in your life, believe me. Now, if you're doing all those things, you are well on your way to being financially fit. The truth is, most of us are not there. I'm not there. Are you? And if you're not, then that should be what you strive for. Okay? I will leave that with you so that that's basically the thrust and the purpose of our program. Being financially fit makes life a lot better. You know, and emergencies come up. I had to go to Chicago to visit my uncle, 96 years old, and so I decided to go by train. Now, folks, I got on board this train, and I was just absolutely shocked. It was a day after the holiday, and so it was packed. I couldn't believe what people were wearing publicly on this train. I was like, oh my God! You know, some of these outfits. Not only were they just unbelievable in terms of not being formal wear, not even being casual wear, just how do you get on? How can you go out in public looking like that? And I came back on an airplane. I remember when you had, not old fashioned, but I remember that you used to dress up if you got on an airplane. Everybody was, you know, dressed to the nines. It was kind of like a social event. And you got on the airplane and they barely wear shoes. It's amazing what people are wearing publicly out there. And, of course, once you get to where you get to, do you change? Or, I mean, where are you going looking like that? I don't know. Look, and that's the subject of my first segment today as we talk with Brandy Britton. Brandy joins us. This is amazing because I think it's so right on the money. Brandy is with a company that has done a very interesting survey. A casual dress code and fashion at work. Dressing up for work continues to go out of style, according to the research. Her company is called Office Team, and they have done she's the district president of this company. And I think it's just hilarious what they found out, and interesting and right on the money in terms of how we are dressing today. No more dressing up. We just won't do it. We don't dress up to go to work. But should we? And I think that's part of what they were trying to find out. The new study of workplace dress codes. And she'll be with us in just a minute. Following her, we're going to also be talking about with Milan Sali from Kiplinger. Now that we know who the Republican presidential candidate is, we look toward the Democrats and see what and once we have them in place, do you know what their plans are for you? What's going to cost? Anyway, we'll get to that. But right now, let's get to Brandy Britton. Brandy, welcome to Home and Family Finance. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted with this survey. I think it's so right. It's so timely. Why did you do this? What was the purpose of it?
Well, typically, Office Team, as an organization, we try to follow workplace trends. And during the summer months, oftentimes, that's when you see dress codes typically push the boundaries. So we thought it was a good time to release this survey.
Okay. So Office Team, and tell me, what is Office Team? So tell me something about your company.
Yeah, we are a division of Robert Half. We specialize in administrative staffing, both on a temporary and temp-to-hire basis, worldwide, actually.
Okay, so if I were looking for people to do a variety of different things, I'd call your company and say, help me find the right people. Is that the way it works?
You got it. Or if you need a position and you've got an administrative background, same thing. We can help you find an opportunity.
Okay, Brandy. Well, you're district president, so to give me your contact information in case I'm one of those who's looking to reach out to you. Where do I go?
Yeah, you can just go to our website. It's www.officeteam.com, mm-hmm. and it lists all of our offices along with phone numbers and email addresses, along with opportunities that are available throughout the country.
That's fascinating. And then are there fees associated with it? What do I have to offer to if I call? Does it cost me something, or do you just want information and help me in that regard?
We are free to talk to.
Okay. All right. Again, well, give me that address again.
OfficeTeam.com.
Yeah, seriously. Listen, I'm very pleased. I mean, you're taking time to join us here. The least that we can do is give you an opportunity to tell people how to reach out to you if they want to do that. We're going to stop for just a minute, and when I come back, I want you to tell me about the research and what you learned and what you think about it. I think it's a great, great topic, and I was surprised to find out that, you know, in fact, a lot of people are not dressing up and don't plan to. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry, here on the Radio America Network. We'll be right back.
We want you to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about. Or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
And have you noticed people are not dressing up so much anymore? It just doesn't seem to be fashionable. I guess that's the truth of it. Brandy Britton is the district president for Office Team, the nation's leading staffing service specializing in the temporary placement of highly skilled administrative and office support professionals. Office Team has more than 300 locations worldwide, and they place tens of thousands of highly skilled candidates each year. So how people dress and what they look like and who they are, all of that has got to be a part of what they do. And they just did a recent survey, and that survey finds out that Brandy, people are more inclined to wear less than formal clothing today. Is that fair?
Yeah, there were two components of it. One was of managers and what their observations were of employees. And 50% of them said that employees today dress less formally than they did about 5 years ago. And then, interestingly, from an employee standpoint, more than 50% of individuals preferred a environment where their dress code was business casual or casual in nature.
And what do you make of that, Brandy? Why? Is it that we're just a less formal nation? What do you make of the results?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, I think, one, formal clothing is not as comfortable as more casual clothing. Casual clothing allows you to demonstrate your personality a little bit more. And we've got a lot of Gen Y and Gen Z or millennials out in the workplace, and those individuals also prefer a more casual environment. So companies, in order to attract individuals, are having to adapt to what the mainstream employees are wanting.
Is that a good thing? Does it have any impact on productivity, whether I am dressed up or not?
Well, interesting question. I think that some people say that they actually perform better when they are more comfortable, and if casual or business casual attire is more comfortable, then hopefully your productivity is much better. Although some people also say that when they're dressed professionally, that they feel better, that they talk better, that they just speak in a more professional manner. So I think it goes either way. But right now, the majority says casual clothing or business casual attire is what makes them more productive and happier at work.
Then I guess you suggest just come in your pajamas. Just be here at 8 o'clock. I mean, and get ready to work. It's a very interesting point. 31% of office workers, according to your survey, stated that they would prefer to be at a company with a business casual dress code, and 27% favor a casual dress code or no dress code at all. But there are limits to what passes as acceptable office attire, and that's another point. When senior managers were asked about the common dress code violation at work, wearing overly casual clothing was a top response, followed by showing too much skin. It's an interesting divide there, isn't it?
It is. Well, the benefit of a business casual or casual dress code is that you are making your employees happier. However, the consequence that comes with that is that it's hard to define what is business casual, what is casual attire, and what's acceptable. So we recommend for employees to dress a step above when they first start a new role and then start to adapt based on what they see the rest of the company wearing. Showing too much skin is always a big problem in the summertime.
Yeah.
So I think the old saying that if it doesn't feel right, then you probably shouldn't wear it. You've got to ask yourself, is this okay? Don't do it.
Yeah. If you're close to that line, stay on the right side of that line, basically, right? If you're asking yourself that question, don't take the chance. By saying, well, I may be there, back off that and be a wee bit more formal, I guess, is where you want to be.
Yes, definitely. You know, lean to being a little bit more professional and ask yourself the question, do I want to be remembered for my work product or for what I wore to work yesterday?
Very, very good point. Very good point. It's a hard line to define. And we live in a world today where kids, young people, are a lot more less formal than my generation and maybe yours. So it has to be respected, but that respect has to go both ways. We're talking here with Brandy Britton, Office Team District President, about how you dress when you get to work or how you should dress. When we come back, we'll ask her more about the results of the survey. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry. Listening to Radio America. I'm your host, Paul Berry. We thank you for joining us, our program sponsor, the Defense Credit Union Council, and we thank them for their continued support of the program dedicated to making all of us smarter consumers. If there's a topic you want us to talk about, please make contact with us. HFFradio.com. We'd like to hear from you. The Defense Credit Union Council and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of Military Saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our troops, wherever they may be serving. Military Saves is a year-round campaign that seeks to motivate, to support, and actually encourage military families to save money, to reduce their debt, and to build wealth. As part of the Department of Defense's financial readiness campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. So check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management and can find partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. Military Saves, set a goal, make a plan, save automatically. Go to militarysaves.org for more information and take the Savers Pledge today. And that pledge ought to be that every month you're going to save at least 5% of whatever you make, however you make it. If you do, and you don't have to be in the military to save, as I always say, if you do that, you're going to be happy. You're going to thank me when they're going to, Paul said we should, and here we have the savings that will help us get through some very tough times. If you've got a job and you want to keep it, and make that money, then you better be sure that you're dressing appropriately. And that doesn't mean you have to dress like we used to years ago. But now there are some rules of the road, and no one knows any better than Brandy Britton. Her office team is designed to bring workers into positions. But as you just heard her talk about, their survey says that there are some changes and there's some things that you can do. Casual is okay, but not too much skin. And now, Brandy, you ask workers which of the following statements most closely describes how a company's dress code impacts your decision to work there. And 31% sense that I would prefer to work at a company that has a business casual dress code. Were you surprised by that?
Actually, no. I think that is the leading dress code, at least here in Los Angeles and throughout other companies or other geographies. People like to dress up a little bit. They just want a little flexibility in what they can wear and not necessarily have to wear a suit from a formal dress code. And I do think that employees are somewhat, even though 27% prefer a casual dress code, oftentimes when they get into that environment, they do like to step it up a little bit because jeans and flip-flops isn't necessarily what they envisioned when they think about casual dress code.
Hey, Brandy, I just paid $600 for this tattoo, and I'm showing it, okay? I am showing this tattoo. I paid a lot of money for it. That's a problem, or can be, right? I mean, you don't have a right to show your tattoo, do you?
Yeah, it depends. So typically, any sort of piercings or tattoos fall within the dress code of a company. And so some companies do not allow the visible tattoos. And therefore, in some cases, women and men both have to cover them up with makeup or with some sort of clothing to prevent that from showing. Or in some cases, employers, although they may not share that with you, may choose to not hire you if they see a visible tattoo in the interview place. So you just have to be careful, ask questions about it, and if you do have a tattoo, target companies that you know that it's going to be okay if it's visible.
And bright, listen, I like bright colors. It's just part of who we are. My family, we wear everything bright. Nobody has a right to tell me whether or not I can wear some bright colors or not. Hmm?
Well, certainly bright colors are nice. It brightens up the room. But there is such thing of too bright of colors or too much fluorescent pink or something like that. So the key question is what I'm wearing bringing too much attention to myself? And it's better to be known for your quality of work rather than what you wore or distract other people in the office. So a little bit of bright is good, but not too much where you're maybe in a monochromatic outfit.
Yeah, okay. But one thing I'm never going to give up is I love my cologne. This is the best stuff I've ever found, and I like everybody to smell it. Am I cool?
You are not cool because everybody else's nose might be burning. So best thing to do is if you love your cologne, wear it out on the weekends or in the evening time, but definitely not to work. And even some organizations are scent free, so you can't wear cologne at all. So just take it easy and do your coworkers a favor. By saving that for the weekend.
Just be smart, I think, is what Brandy's trying to tell you, folks. Don't have to stand out that way. Stand out in your production of work. Brandy, thanks so much for joining us. What a pleasure to have you on the show. Come back and see us again, would you please?
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure. Folks, use good common sense. That's all we're talking about. Now, coming up next, are you Republican or Democrat? And do you know what the rules are for them in terms of how they're going to make things happen? When we come back, we'll talk about that. Stay with us.
Helping you be safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Barry.
Guys, we're right square in the middle of the political silly season. No question about it. We now know for sure who the Republican candidate for president will be. And unless something happens that's untoward, and I don't think that's going to be the case, we will know who the Democrat candidate is. Of course, we're talking about Donald J. Trump. And we're also talking about Mrs. Clinton, Hillary Clinton. It's been a difficult time getting here. I mean, difficult in the sense that we as the audience have been subjected to everything you could imagine. But the question is, what do we really know about these two candidates and how they are going to impact our pocketbooks? As far as we know right now, what is their stand and how will it affect our wallets? It's a very honest and fair question. And what do you know? Do you know where they stand or do you not? Thanks to our folks at Kiplinger, they have done a little bit of study on this, and they've looked at 9 issues that could affect your pocketbook. Do you know where they stand, and do you care? Milan Solly is editor for Kiplinger. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. And, Milan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. How much do we know, or is it possible that we can know at this point, or is it too early to know where these two candidates stand and what the impact will be on us?
So basically what we did with this article was we researched all the official platforms that are out there right now. We also kind of tried to look at some of the key quotes and interviews that these candidates have said in the past. But we've also, of course, acknowledged the fact that these platforms are going to change as we get closer to November and the actual election.
Okay. The areas that you suggest, and I think that the article was comprehensive in that, and I appreciate it, economic growth and jobs, taxes, health care, Social Security, climate change, infrastructure, student debt, paying down the public debt, defense spending, and a couple of other items. So from your perspective, Milan, what are most of us more likely going to be impacted by one or the other, no matter what their positions are?
I think one of the really essential issues here is taxes, because if you look at Clinton versus Trump's platforms, there's an independent group called the Tax Policy Center, and they actually found that Clinton's proposals would increase federal revenue by $1.1 trillion, while Trump's would kind of reduce revenue by $9.5 trillion. Now, if you just kind of look at the plans, the two of them are extremely different. So, for example, Clinton's plan wouldn't really change taxes for the bottom 95% of taxpayers, but the top 1% would see these really sizable increases. And then on the other hand, you have Donald Trump, who's proposing tax cuts just all across the board, and that would, you know, in turn, really decrease revenue.
Then the next question, I guess, Milan, is which one can we live with? I mean, can we reduce taxes across the board as per Donald Trump and survive as a nation? Or are we better off with some tax increases at the top and static at the bottom?
What Kiplinger really tried to do in this article was kind of to present both sides of the candidates' platforms and not really come to our own, you know, judgment.
Yeah, yeah.
About
okay. Well,
better,
tell us about both sides. I mean, in other words, you've done that. This is where they are, but you don't say what the impact would be, or you don't know at this point.
We say kind of what the impact would be in terms of, especially for taxes. We talked about the specific changes that are proposed, and also how that would affect the federal revenue. And then later in our paying for public debt section, we do talk about what these candidates would have to do to make the debt sustainable if they implemented policies like these tax proposals.
Mm-hmm.
So it is just, we do kind of conclude what would happen, but we don't really say this is going to be better than that option.
Okay, and I want everybody, you can go, by the way, as I did, you can go to the website, and the article by Milan and others, it's right there and available to you. This was a big project that they did, and we thank you very much for doing it. And you can go right there and read up on issues. Now, I know everybody's not going to go there, so from the standpoint of what's going to cost me more or less when it comes to taxes, were you able to come to any conclusion on that, Milan?
So it really depends on what your tax bracket is. So like I said, for Clinton, you probably aren't going to be paying any more if you're not in the top 1% of the tax bracket. But on the other hand, for Trump, if you're in any tax bracket, really, you're going to see a pretty sizable drop in your taxes. So, for example, Trump wants to shrink the number of federal tax brackets from 7 to 3, and then he also wants single filers earning less than $25,000 and joint filers earning less than $50,000 to pay absolutely no taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at that, it does seem like under Trump you might pay less taxes. But the interesting thing is the Tax Policy Center also found that the top 0.1% of taxpayers would receive an average cut of 19% of their income, whereas the middle class would see closer to 4%. So it's actually not as much of a tax break for the middle class as the wealthy.
Okay. And is this ironclad? I mean, can either candidate decide, well, that's what I proposed then, but this is what I got to do now? I mean, that's the other part of this, right? Nothing is ironclad. They can change their proposals.
Yeah, at this point, these are just proposals, and they've both talked about modifying the ones that they have right now. So, for example, Clinton, she has said that she wants to introduce more tax breaks for the middle class, but right now her plan doesn't really include that. And Trump, you know, people have put pressure on him saying, look, this is going to really decrease the federal revenue. What are you going to do? But he has said, and I think we highlighted this in a key Trump quote, that even if he does increase taxes on the wealthy from his current proposal, he really wants them to end up paying less than they're paying right now.
Fascinating stuff. My guest, Esmail Ansaldi. We're talking, she's with Kiplinger, one of the editors there. When we come back, let's talk about economic growth and jobs, important to all of us. What a great idea to have this so we can take a look at it and make some decisions. Thank you. We'll be right back. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Barry.
We want you to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about. Or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Barry.
All right, folks, when it comes to presidential politics, we know the players, but do we know the game? That's where we are right now. The players are there. They put forth their proposals, if you will, and you and I will live under those proposals if they, in fact, become the rule of law, if they, in fact, become what is implemented by the players. And those players, of course, are Mr. Trump and Ms. Clinton. So let's and my guest has taken a look at that for us and narrows it down. Milan Sali is the editor, is Kiplinger, one of Kiplinger's editors, and she joins us. And there's a great article that you can find and read if you will do so by going to kiplinger.com. Let's look at economic growth and jobs. What did you find?
So we looked at Trump and Clinton's proposals, and we found that they're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. So Trump really wants to pull back from kind of this free market orthodoxy, and he's proposed one of his ways for doing that is to impose a 35% tariff on goods that are imported from Mexico and a 45% tariff on goods that are imported from China. And interestingly enough, we looked at an analysis by the independent firm Moody's Analytics, and they discovered that if Trump actually succeeds in imposing these tariffs and then in turn China and Mexico place tariffs on the U.S., all of those countries involved are going to fall into a recession.
They would fall into recession, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It would not be good for, because it's essentially a tax on the consumer, and it would really be bad for American business.
So the impact of it sounds good at the top, but there may be some underlying impacts that we wouldn't be happy with. Is that a
sense? Yeah, definitely.
Okay. What about that wall? I mean, is he really going to build that wall?
Yeah, so we looked at that also, and in terms of, that's kind of more of an infrastructure issue, but one of the things that really stood out to us is that he's quoted this number of about $4 to $12 billion in order to cover costs for the wall. But a lot of experts have actually found that it's going to be closer to $25 billion and an additional $750 million per year to cover maintenance costs. So those are obviously very, very high costs that he would have to find a way to cover at the same time as, you know, cutting these taxes and not really cutting a lot of other government spending.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And part of that, of course, is looking at, when we talk about jobs, part of that that wall is kind of protect the jobs for Americans. But the question becomes for both of them, are jobs going to be more prevalent for one or the other, or are their programs dissimilar?
So from the jobs aspect, what Clinton is really pushing for is to kind of have a clean energy infrastructure, and then also just more general infrastructure improvements. And she thinks that would really do a lot to create American jobs. She's not really pushing for a strong anti-immigration agenda, whereas Trump, you know, has said that he really wants to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants and also build this wall. And he thinks that would do a lot to create American jobs. He also has an idea for an infrastructure plan where he would spend, he hasn't quoted a specific figure, but about $1 trillion. And he thinks that would create around 13 million jobs.
Okay. And folks, by the way, we're not pushing one or the other. Let me just be clear on that. My job is not to tell you what to think, but to tell you what to think about. And what I'm telling you what to think about is go there, read this information. You're going to have to make your own decisions, because you're going to have to make decisions who you're going to vote for. So learn about this. Know about this. Don't walk into that booth not sure who's going to do what. Kiplinger has done a great service to all of us by putting all of this out there in simple, understandable language. But they can't make you read it. You have to do it yourself, so please do. My guest is Milan Sali. She's one of the people involved in putting this information together. Let's talk about health care. I hear very clearly Don doesn't make doesn't bite his lip. He says, I'm going to repeal health care, the Obamacare, as it's known, affordable health care is its real name. What does Hillary say?
Yeah, so Trump, you know, obviously, he wants to repeal Obamacare, but Clinton is really kind of saying that she'll continue President Obama's work and work to expand Obamacare. So a few of her main focuses include lowering out-of-pocket and prescription drug costs, and she also really wants to make premiums more affordable. And she has a few ideas, including tax credits and kind of capping premiums at a certain limit.
Okay. That sounds, I guess, okay. Or maybe not. What about Mr. Trump? I mean, if you repeal something's out there, you got to replace it with something. Has he indicated what that would be?
Yes, Trump has said that if he repeals Obamacare, he wants to really allow individuals to shop for private medical coverage across state lines, and he thinks that would encourage competition and also drive down costs. Another one of his ideas is to expand the use of health savings accounts, which would be able to accumulate tax-free contributions and then be able to be passed down as part of the state, and that would be with no penalty.
Well, would he repeal the entire health care bill as we know it, Obamacare as we know it, or would he just take down parts of it that he didn't like, or has he indicated that? I mean, it's such a – I remember how big it was, Milan, to put this in place in the first place. I'm not sure it was the right thing to do or wrong, but the point is we've got to have health care for the nation. So from the Kiplinger's point of view, will both plans work?
I would say that Trump, well, kind of getting back to the first part of what you're saying, he definitely would want to repeal, I would say, at least most of, if not all of Obamacare, because one of the key quotes that we highlighted in the slideshow is Trump saying, "We have a disaster called the big lie, Obamacare. You have to be hit by a tractor, literally, to use it, because the deductibles are so high, it's virtually useless." So he's very much against Obamacare and would definitely want to repeal it. In terms of whether these two plans, which one, you know, would be better for the American
right.
people, again, we didn't really conclude that, but
okay.
That's kind of where we stand on it.
Well, one issue that, and I'm not forgetting, and I'm saving Social Security and Medicare for our last, because even though it's related to this, well, maybe no, because it is related to this. Let's talk a little bit about that. So Social Security and Medicare. Are their plans dissimilar?
Yeah, so Clinton would really want to expand Social Security benefits. You know, she opposes privatization, and her focuses with Social Security would be to really expand benefits for women who are widows or for people who have left the workforce to care for others, whether that's, you know, an elderly spouse, parents, or children. Trump, on the other hand, repeatedly throughout his campaign, he said that he wouldn't cut Social Security. And, you know, we have him quoted in the slideshow saying he's not a cutter and he's one of the only people, Republicans, who would not cut Social Security. But if you look at some recent comments by his advisor, Sam Clovis, mm-hmm. he's kind of hinted at potential entitlement cuts once Trump actually takes office. And then in terms of Medicare, Trump has a very similar opinion. You know, he said he wouldn't cut Medicare, but now these comments by Sam Clovis are kind of going against that, so we're not truly sure what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of Hillary's plan for Medicare, she has this proposal called Medicare for More, where she would let individuals over 50 or 55 buy in, and she thinks that would really do a good job of distributing the cost and kind of making Medicare more sustainable.
Wow. My guest is Milan Solly. She is editor at Kiplinger's. Folks, this is such a great service that they've done, and you can go to their website and read more and learn more. Again, our job is not to tell you what to think, but what to think about. And there are numbers of items and issues that are facing us all as Americans. You need to know about them, and you need to form your opinion before you go in and decide what sliver you're going to pull in the voting box. When we come back, we're going to talk about high debt. Stay with us. You're listening to Home and Family Finance, where we ask the question, are you financially fit? Are you making more than you spend, or are you spending more than you make? Answer that honestly, and you'll know which road you're on, okay? My guest is Milan Solly. She is a Kiplinger editor, and the Kiplinger letter has an interesting look at the two candidates, and we know who they are now, and what their proposals are, everything from economic growth, taxes, health care, Social Security and Medicare, climate change, infrastructure, student debt, defense spending. Now, we've covered some very interesting topics, and my thanks to Milan for being so candid about this. But where I want to go now is about student debt. There are lots of young people out there, over $1.3 trillion in student debt, even more than credit card debt. What's going to happen here? What are the plans for these two people? Take us through what each one is proposing, would you, Milan?
Plan is something she calls the New College Compact, and she actually recently updated it to say that by 2021, students from households earning up to $125,000 per year would qualify for free in-state public school tuition. And she also would offer free tuition at community colleges. Some other parts of her plan include helping borrowers refinance their loans at the same rates as new student borrowers, and also automatically delaying the payments on federal loans for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So she has a lot of ideas wrapped up in that plan, and she said that she would, you know, fund those by cutting taxes or increasing taxes on the wealthy. And then Trump, on the other hand, he doesn't really have a detailed plan to address college debt, but he definitely acknowledges that it's an issue that we need to talk about. So, for example, at a Wisconsin town hall meeting, he said, we're going to do something for the students. We're going to have something with extensions and lower interest rates and a lot of good things.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really have a platform for him to work off of, but one of the advisors, Sam Clovis, who I mentioned earlier, has said that Trump opposes Clinton's plan for a debt-free higher education just because he doesn't think that there's any way to viably pay for it. And he kind of supports private banks in offering loans rather than the federal government.
Okay, and folks, what I want to say to you right now, this is July, and so we do have a few months, and so do the candidates, to kind of coalesce their positions, to kind of decide what they really want to be. And let's give them a break and say, okay, take the time. But what you must say, I submit, to both candidates is, okay, I want to know. I'll give you that. I'll give you August and maybe September to come up with something that makes me feel comfortable. And that's what this is all about. This is your tax dollars. This is your country. These are your leaders. Which one are you going to select? And what do you know about them? And what do you know about what their plans are? You have to find out, and you have to ask the question, and you have to demand that they both come up with answers so that you can then make an informed decision about which way you plan to go. It's okay to be a Republican, okay to be a Democrat or an independent, but ultimately you have to make a choice. And the choice is important because that's the way this country will go for the next 4 years. What surprised you, if anything, about the positions, Milan? Or what, did you see anything that particularly stood out that you thought was of interest or should be to the public?
What I think is interesting, especially about Clinton's plan, is that, you know, since she did revise it in the past few weeks, she's kind of adopted a few aspects of Bernie Sanders' plan, you know, where he was really calling for free tuition. Because previously she wasn't explicitly saying, you know, if you earn up to X amount, then you'll have free in-state public school tuition. Mm-hmm. Her proposal was a little more modest. So I think that's definitely one interesting aspect of it. And then on Trump's side, I think another quote that we had from him was that he thinks it's terrible that one of the only profit centers we have is student loans. So I think it's interesting because this is one of the areas where Clinton and Trump, they do kind of agree that this is a really serious issue we need to address. But again, they just have kind of dissimilar methods of addressing it.
Is either side even contemplating, thinking about, suggesting, mentioning debt forgiveness for this $1.3 trillion?
Neither of them have that explicitly written out in their platforms. But, you know, as you said, it's August. Perhaps they'll say something further down the road.
Right, right. And when it comes to climate change, how close were they in terms of what – did both agree that there is climate change and something should be done?
They're on opposite ends of the spectrum for that. So Clinton believes in climate change, and she has this idea – to make America the clean energy superpower of the 21st century, doing things like installing solar panels, focusing on renewable energy, and reducing oil consumption. Then on the other hand, you have Trump, who does not believe in climate change, and he would actually cut funding to the Environmental Protection Agency. He would stop sending tax dollars to the UN, and he would withdraw from the Paris Agreement, which is this international pledge to lower emissions. He's really more focused on fossil fuels, including coal, and
yeah.
One of his goals is a complete American energy self-sufficiency.
Folks, what you've just heard is out there. All you have to do is look it up. Go to Kiplinger.com and find out what's on the minds of those that we're going to elect as the next president of these United States. Milan Solly, what a great job you've done. Thanks. Editor at Kiplinger Magazine joining us here. It's good information, and I appreciate you being with us. Come back and see us again, would you please?
Yes, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You bet. And we're here every week, folks. And nobody's giving you the information that we're given. So you get it right here. Come back and see us. We hope you will. We've enjoyed being with you. Al, thank you. Al, what a great job you're doing there. You know, what would I do without you? Thank you so much for being with us. Al Peterson and Tally Berry. We'll be back next week.